When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode of the Single Tracks podcast is sponsored by Glowworm Lights. Glowworm is a mountain bike light brand founded almost a decade ago by two mountain bikers in New Zealand, and today the company offers some of the highest quality bike lights on the market, including Bluetooth control and complete customization through their app. Glowworm's complete line of lights start at 1200 lumens and range up to a blinding 3600 lumens, all at reasonable prices. Save 15% off all light systems on the Glowworm website with the coupon code SINGLETRACKS2021. Shop for lights at glowwormlights.co.nz and be sure to check for the link in the show notes.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Single Tracks podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Christopher Blevins. This year, Christopher became the first American man to win a World Cup race since 1994, taking first in the final cross-country Olympic race at the end of the season in Snowshoe, West Virginia. He's also the reigning short track world champion and has notched numerous podium finishes at national and international mountain, cyclocross, and road races. This month, he's got a short documentary film titled The Long Traverse that will be premiering online. Thanks for joining us, Christopher.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. Yeah.
Well, so I want to start talking a little bit about your background. You grew up in Durango and participated in the Durango Devo community-based cycling program. How did that program shape who you are as a rider?
Yeah, man, you know, it has everything to do with the rider I am and the person I am, truly. You know, growing up in Durango, you can look 360 degrees around you and see where a bike can take you.
Yeah.
You know, like I had neighbors who were Olympians, right? Ned Overin lived right up my hill. But I also, you know, you could see a bike can help you coach and work in a bike shop as, you know, a skilled mechanic. You can travel around the world, like filming bikes or something. So it was really like, it's really woven into the community.
Yeah.
And Devo is a part of that. And the whole philosophy is to develop lifelong cyclists, and we kind of accidentally get fast in that process.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, what is it then about Durango, though, that produces so many talented riders, do you think? I mean, you mentioned there's Olympians, Ned Overend is there, there's all kinds of athletes that come out of there. Is it the elevation, the terrain, or is it just that community that's there in place?
Yeah. I mean, that's a question I'm trying to answer myself. You know, I mean, there's no magic secret to Durango beyond all of the people. And in the sheer fact, we have, you know, hundreds of miles of trails out the back door.
Right.
But it's really the people, like Sarah Tesher and Chad Cheney, the founders of Durango Devo, you know, have created something that parents move to Durango now to put their kids in Devo, like other parents, different places to put their kids in some school.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a testament to how incredible the program is as a foundational learning tool and development tool, you know, externally of cycling. That's just the way in to building confidence and community. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different pieces to that. And
yeah.
Like, you know, you just got to go to Durango and kind of talk to those people. And then it's like, oh, okay, that's why.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Super unique. And what's interesting too, I mean, Fort Lewis College there, right? Obviously has like a really good cycling program, but then you chose to leave Durango, right? For college and everything. So yeah, again, I guess it's the community that's there, but there are also multiple paths, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know, I think, you know, people who grew up in a small town can relate to, you know, looking elsewhere for college. And it was a really good decision for me. Like my sister, other families out in California.
Okay.
I wanted to choose a college that I would choose independently of cycling, but at the same time, be able to pursue the Olympics.
Yeah.
In college, right?
Right.
And just frankly, collegiate cycling is not built really to support that. In mountain biking, it may be different for track or road in some ways, but it's almost a better path for certain individuals. It really depends on where, you know, where you're at. But for me, better to carve out my own sort of individual training and cycling program alongside my school.
Yeah.
And here in San Luis Obispo, I have community and friends who can push me as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, your upcoming film, The Long Traverse, is sort of set there near San Luis Obispo in California. And I want to talk about, so at the beginning, you kind of open and close with some of your spoken word poetry. So that's one of my first questions is like, how did you get interested in that and build kind of the skills for doing that?
Well, you know, freshman year of high school, I had a poetry unit and I was like, man, I actually like this. Like I've been writing raps like, you know, a lot of eighth graders do, you know, and then I started to realize, wow, I can actually use this to express some things. And and I really like rhyming and all of that. So that's where it started. And it's stuck with me. You know, it's always been just a different kind of outlet to cycling, a different outlet, a different form of the same expression, if that makes sense. You know, there's not really that many intrinsic differences in, like, you know, expressing yourself through something like cycling versus poetry and music, but it's obviously an entirely different medium. But yeah, and then like freshman year of college, I wrote an album that was really like a rite of passage for me, you know, kind of culmination of Mile Marker 18. The album's called Mile Markers, and it's like stepping out of high school into adulthood.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's cool now to be able to weave it back into the sport with something like The Long Traverse.
Yeah, that's really cool. I mean, do you have other outlets for it as well? I mean, this seemed like a natural one, right? Like a video, and like in the mountain bike world, like we watch a lot of videos and we love videos. But yeah, I mean, do you get to like perform it live, or like what else are you able to do with that sort of passion, and how do you share it?
Yeah. I mean, I've always wanted to have that little, you know, cafe or bar you can go in and do open mic nights and like have your community there. And you know, the fact is I can't do everything at once, and right now I'm a bike racer, right? So it means I'll probably be recovering instead of going to an open mic night at a bar.
Yeah,
but that will be available to the future, you know.
Yeah,
just like cycling is something that kind of sticks with you and you can do it when you're older, so is poetry and music and writing. So right now, you know, in the past couple of years with the Olympics and everything, like I've took a couple more advanced poetry classes in college, which was really exciting to learn about sonic texture and form. That was kind of the way to carry that forward. But yeah, for now, you know, it is in the background to cycling, but that's okay with me.
Mm, yeah. That's interesting that you say you can't do everything at once, because looking at like your resume so far, I mean, you're young and you've already done so many like really different things, you know, from like BMX to road to cyclocross to winning all these mountain bike races. And the other thing that I'm really struck by is you're like a really talented and playful rider on the bike. And I'm curious to know, like, how does that translate into racing, like that sort of playfulness and style, if you will?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that the playfulness all comes from BMX in Durango Devo, you know, like the people like Steven Davis, who's marathon national champion, who I grew up riding with. And I mean, Steven and I riding when we were like 12 and whatever, 15, like it was incredible. We just like do these insane lines and our coach is leading us, and it was all fun and play based, you know?
Yeah.
And that came from, I think, the mix of different, you know, disciplines I dabbled in, or really stuck myself in growing up, but primarily BMX. And then I think, you know, when I race, I'm actually far less playful than I am every time I ride, you know? And it's funny, it's something I've been thinking about recently. Like my legs are just locked straight out when I'm descending so I can recover more.
Yeah.
I don't want to be someone who pops a wheelie or does a no-hander in a race, because I'm in that race to win, you know?
Right.
But the second the race is done, if there's a pump track right there and I have any energy left, I'll go do it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But yeah, I mean, there's always room, even in the middle of the Olympics or something, to let what you learned from playing on the bike come back in and help you go faster.
Yeah. I mean, has it affected you though, like where you are right now in your racing career? Do you, I don't know, sort of second guess those times when you're like, oh, I'm going to go hit the pump track. And then you're like, maybe I shouldn't, because I don't want to, you know, fall and break my wrist.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I've like grown up as a BMX kid, like I've broken my wrist a number of times. I, you know, have literally three quarters of my life of like learning what not to do, you know?
Yeah.
With jump, I probably shouldn't hit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm, you know, I'm good at that. And I'm not really willing to take risks right now. You know, my career is bike racing. So I'm not going to go to the bike park and do something crazy, but
yeah,
it's always like, there's always a balance there and you just got to kind of intuitively know what it is for yourself.
Yeah. Makes sense. Well, I want to get back to talking more about the film. So a big part of this is about this Los Padres route in, I believe it's the Los Padres National Forest, right? Tell us a bit about the route and like how that came together and sort of your involvement.
Yeah. So I live in San Luis Obispo and it's 45 minutes from the start of the route, which is in between Santa Maria and Coyama, California.
Okay.
Out in the valley on the other side of the Los Padres. And then the route, the Los Padres Traverse, climbs up and over the Sierra Madre Mountains down to Lake Achuma, which is close to Santa Barbara. So you're like, you could continue for 20 miles or so and get to the Pacific Ocean.
Okay.
And on the way, you come from, you know, the east, which overlooks the Mojave Desert. You start at 2,000 feet. Climb up to 5,500 and like trace the top of this ridge,
mm-hmm.
which is like, if anybody goes and looks at the film or looks at any graphics, like there's these wavy ridges that just go and go and go. And it's really
yeah.
an amazing place. And it's right under the nose of a place like Santa Barbara, close to Los Angeles. And a lot of people don't really know what's out there in the Los Padres.
Yeah.
And the route is 80 miles. 11,000 feet of climbing goes up to over 6,000 feet. Like all of a sudden it's like you're in Lake Tahoe.
Yeah.
And I didn't see a single soul for all 80 miles, you know? So it's really rugged. And if you're, you know, if anyone's interested in doing it themselves, do the research and be prepared, bring a spot device.
Yeah.
But in a larger view, this route, like, yeah, it's an amazing bike ride. It's one of the most amazing one day rides you can do. Truly.
Mm-hmm.
But it also is incredible in the like history of the route and kind of the different stories, which we can get into. I do want to say, you know, the route was established by Dylan Jones, who is a Santa Barbara local. And I talked to him a while ago. And then like Menso De Jong, some people who are local to Santa Barbara,
mm-hmm.
have done it a handful of times. And Dylan, I mean, the route has been there for you know, hundreds of years, really, like in different
yeah.
But yeah, Dylan is the one who first did it, I think, in a day.
Mm.
And then I was talking to Chris Burkhard about it. And that was kind of the impetus from there. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Well, so the film, you know, a big part of it is you sort of preparing and then racing for a fastest known time attempt along the route. So I'm curious to hear some of the things you learned about, you know, the route and about yourself in that whole process of preparing and then ultimately racing.
Yeah. So I was starting to say is this is an iconic ride in an incredibly hard FKT, you know, or
mm-hmm.
whatever, big effort. There's not really a word for the non-FKT, but it's like the White Rim in Moab, but I think it's honestly harder. It's even more rugged out there. But like I went into this wanting to, you know, establish this FKT and like learn about the area,
mm-hmm.
but I really wasn't thinking about what it meant to ride something that has this much history in it, excuse me.
Yeah.
And how much I could learn through that process. And it really came from Dylan Osleger, who is the, another Dylan, not Dylan Jones,
yeah.
runs the Santa Barbara Trail Association and is a climate scientist and is really on the forefront of advocating for, you know, appropriate trail restoration and stewardship as it, you know, coincides with like policy and climate change. So
mm-hmm.
I learned a ton from him. And the primary thing, which I say in the film is like, we think of something like an FKT as going out and kind of conquering the land, right? You're like, you're
right.
this route, you're making it through.
Mm-hmm.
But it's much more beautiful, I think, when you fold kind of into the land and you really appreciate where you're riding and the fact that you get to ride there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this route, you know, the history from the Chumash peoples who were there, the wild wilderness zones established on both sides of the road. Ranching along with extraction and everything. There's a lot to unpack, and the bike is just the way in to having those conversations that I otherwise, you know, wouldn't have. And
yeah,
that's been the most amazing part of the process.
Yeah, I mean, the film is really different from a lot of mountain bike films, and the FKT attempt too. I mean, like, you're in there, and it's clear that you're talking to people like Dylan Oeslinger and, you know, some of the folks who know about the history of the area. And then even there's one point, I think, you know, you said it was your first time doing trail work in a while. So you were actually like out there working on the trail. Like, what did all of that do for you, like, in terms of your attempt? Were you able to do that before the attempt, or was this afterward that you kind of went back and learned all that stuff?
Yeah, that was before. So that was back in March. And what you didn't see is just how muddy it was out there, you know, like, so it was good trail work conditions, terrible riding conditions.
Right.
But, you know, yeah, it was, I'm not embarrassed to say at this point, it was the first day of trail work in 5 years that I've done, right?
Yeah.
So many of us take for granted the places we get to ride. And mm-hmm. I've been one of them, right? Like, I ride so much amazing single track, and there are thousands of people and thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars mm-hmm. that go in that single track.
Yeah.
And living in California now, thousands of miles of single track are burning every year. Like, it's just going to happen.
Right.
At that point. So acknowledging through something as simple as, yeah, caring for the trail that you love the most, going out and volunteering for trail days, you start to develop more of a connection to that land that the trail is on, and understand, like, yeah, you're not just shredding that berm just for the sake of that berm.
Right.
You can actually, like I said, fold into the land a bit more. And it's much more rewarding. It's a much more beautiful experience to see the depth of riding in that way, you know? Mm. I think 2 years ago or something, I would have thought of trail work as a burden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now I see it as a way to appreciate riding even more. Mm. And that's available to all of us.
Yeah, interesting. But also in the film, you mention sort of the carbon footprint that's associated with professional bike racing. And I'm curious about that as well. Is that like a new realization for you as a result of this process? Or is this something you've been thinking about for a while?
Yeah, well, you know, I wasn't sure what my place was in conversations around the environment. Mm-hmm. Many of us feel that way. We don't know how to be a part of, you know, advocating for clean air, you know, mm-hmm. clean water and a healthy planet, right? It's like, I mean, that's what it is. And we all care about that. But we all also live in a system that, especially if you're traveling a lot for your job, like I am, mm-hmm. where your carbon impact footprint is quite high.
Yeah.
And, you know, my job, I'm going to be flying on planes all over the country. But the way that I've learned from smart people to think about where we're at collectively is, like, there are systemic problems that individual action cannot solve. Individual action is a part of it, but it's about collectively understanding what systems we're occupying and how to change policy and everything like that. And I think that, you know, the mountain bike industry, the cycling industry generally, has a lot of work to do there, but it's not something we have to do, right? It's not like a burden. There's so much to be gained from stepping into that conversation.
Right.
Including, you know, lowering our individual carbon footprint, but more importantly, understanding how our voice as an industry mm-hmm. can advocate for appropriate policy, legislation, and people who are out there stewarding the land.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, I think you're onto something here too. I mean, it's this younger generation of riders and athletes like yourself that are really stepping up and saying, look, we're mountain bikers. We like mountain biking because we love the environment. Like, over the years, I feel like mountain bikers have been painted as sort of enemies to the environment by, like, hiking groups or different other outdoor recreationists. And, you know, the fact is, like, we love riding because we love trees and we love clean water and all the things you're talking about. So that's a really awesome sort of platform for you to be able to help bring more awareness to, for sure.
Yeah. You know, and what I've learned, like, throughout this project, the Launch Traverse, is like I said, and I'll say it again, is there's so much to not gain, but, like, reclaim throughout this. You know, it's not something you're going to lose by volunteering at trail work or, like,
right,
you know, stepping into this conversation. And I think cycling has a lot of, is lagging behind the skiing industry or climbing mm-hmm. that are really at the forefront of talking about the places that they get to recreate in. And this is sort of something we're going to have to do whether we choose to, you know, consciously, or next year, 5,000 miles of single track burn, right? Like, it's just going to continue to happen. And we're going to continue to lose the places we love to ride. But more importantly, the communities that those trails are in are going to suffer.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I'm curious to know, is this your first FKT attempt, your first major one that you've done?
Yeah, I rode the White Rim solo in a day. It went pretty hard, but like wasn't going for the FKT. I was just trying to do this 6-hour workout my coach had put on the calendar. It was just a convenient way to do it. But yeah, I really think this model of FKT, you know, on routes is really cool. And it's obviously come out of the pandemic and social distance events and everything. What I want to emphasize is like, it shouldn't just be these 80 mile routes that only a handful of people can do in a day. Like there's a different kind of FKT, which is like, you know, funnest known time, you know,
right.
And you bring some friends and you bring a sleeping pad and you camp out. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's my hope and creatively where I want to go with my new production company is like telling that story, allowing people to step into a route like Long Traverse, a route like the Los Padres, and they can choose. You can either go fast and test yourself on it, or you can do, you know, an intermediate option, or you can bike pack the long one. But it's about consciously choosing a route that can tell a landscape story and benefit the community that that route is in. And all at the same time, like a sweet route, right? Like an incredible ride on the bike.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I'm curious to know too, like as a professional athlete, how is it different when you're racing an FKT versus a World Cup? I mean, obviously the crowds are incredibly different. The courses are different. Is one more challenging, would you say, or are they just different?
Yeah. Well, you know, my primary discipline, cross country mountain biking, is far from a 6-hour ride. It's an hour and a half and it's like brutally intense from the jump.
Yeah.
But a lot of my training, I do a ton of 4-hour, 5-hour high endurance rides where you're basically going hard all day. Mm-hmm. And that's like how you build an engine. And that's exactly what FKTs are, is pushing yourself and really digging into that, like that high level that like you can't go too much above and you can't go too much below if you want to go fast. So
yeah,
it really builds fitness and it's obviously a mental thing too, to lock in solo for 6 hours versus have thousands of fans screaming at you for an hour and a half.
Right. Yeah. Well, it almost sounds like you're suggesting that, like, I mean, could you potentially be setting those FKTs as part of your training and then like turning around and going and racing in the World Cup? Or are these like two sort of separate things? Like you can only focus on one at a time.
Yeah. Well, that's something, you know, we touched on a little bit in the film, but not that much. Is like, I had just come back from the Olympics when I did the FKT. I had like a week off and then a week up in Truckee at my girlfriend's, just like riding for fun, goofing off. Mm-hmm. And then I, you know, only had a couple weeks until the World Championships. And last thing I wanted to do after the Olympics is do intervals on pavement, you know?
Yeah.
So that was the perfect opportunity to train by adventure. And having something like that, I learned throughout the pandemic that picking Strava segments instead of doing intervals or creating a mock race is a really beneficial way to train. Gives you a carrot to chase.
Yeah.
And an FKT is just that. So I didn't think I was going that well after the Olympics. I was tired, as many people are after something like that.
Right.
And I was like, all right, just going to ride out the rest of the season. And then, I ended up having the best month of my life.
Yeah.
Athletically. And I think that something like, well, the effort in the Los Padres did set me up for that.
Yeah, that's really interesting and surprising too, I'm sure, because it's not like, I don't know that fits into a lot of training models, existing ones anyway. I mean, yeah, maybe you're kind of charting a new one. So it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about tourism, environmental issues, and Christopher's historic World Cup win earlier this year. Stay tuned.
The next time you're shopping for mountain bike gear, check out singletracks.com/deals. Each week, we share our favorite product picks and exclusive coupon codes from our partners. You can also use the page to search for whatever you're buying, from complete mountain bikes to brake sets and tire sealant. That's singletracks.com/deals. And to get our weekly picks delivered to your inbox, be sure to sign up for our newsletter. Links to the newsletter and deals page are in the show notes.
And we're back. So, Christopher, we kind of talked about this, but the film raises a number of issues from climate change to forest fires and even indigenous land acknowledgments. So I'm curious to hear more about sort of your role as a professional athlete, what you see as your role in all of these issues. You mentioned climate change and forest fires. And I guess the one we haven't really talked about is this indigenous land acknowledgement. So what's kind of your thinking behind including that, and how are you able to sort of promote that idea?
Yeah. Well, you know, first and foremost, like the opportunity I have as a bike racer, as someone who gets to ride 20 to 30 hours a week and call that my job,
yeah,
is one of privilege. And it's one where I can learn so much through the bike. Like I started bike racing at a very high level when I was 5 years old.
Yeah. Geez.
And you know, the bike has always been a classroom of sorts, you know? Mm. And I'm just realizing now that the depth of learning that can come from riding, you know, or stopping, mm-hmm. to, you know, and looking around after a ride sometimes is really immense. And it's also like, you know, my experience riding and racing is very different than someone who's just getting into it for the first time. Mm. And that's special, right? That the bike has such a diversity of experiences people can have. Mm-hmm. And now with that, you know, with the fact that I can learn so much through the bike, that's the opportunity that is truly a responsibility in some ways, but a special thing that I can undertake, right? Mm. And I have a lot of indigenous friends on the Navajo Nation, and one in particular who's from the Blackfeet Reservation, McKaylee Oliver, who's in the film. Mm-hmm. And learning about how the bike is a form of expression in culture for them, mm-hmm. you know, it's the fundamental same, you know, feeling of just riding your bike. But on the Navajo Nation, the trails that are there that people are building or rebuilding, mm-hmm. were initially shepherd trails, you know, for sheep and horses. Mm-hmm. And for centuries, Dene people have used those trails. And that the bike is just a way to continue that tradition. And it's something that is entirely beyond the bike, right? Like it really is. And it's what I'm talking about with a connection to the land. And there's no better people to learn from and to lead these conversations than indigenous peoples who've, you know, stewarded the land for centuries and have been,
yeah,
forcibly removed at times. Right. Mm-hmm. So as far as that relates to riding your bike, you know, it does, right. It's here. And it's like,
yeah,
it's one way to get out on the land and to have these conversations. So yeah, you know, there's continued learning along this vein that I want to go on, but I'm fundamentally stepping into an understanding that like indigenous leadership and issues of the climate is really important.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's really timely as well. I'm curious also to hear sort of your take on how we can balance the positives that tourism can bring to an area and also the impact that that has in terms of our carbon footprint of travel and also the strain on local resources. Like what's kind of the way that we can balance those two things out in your opinion?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm relaying a lot of what I've learned from Dylan and the Protect Our Winters crew. And just to, you know, run down kind of the statistics, and this is especially relevant to California and the Western states, but outdoor recreation is a bigger industry as far as jobs than extraction. And, you know, there's a lot of dollars, $900 billion for the outdoor industry in the United States. And there's a powerful voice there. And it, like I said, it supports a lot of jobs. It is not perfect, obviously. I mean, that includes snowmobiling and motorsports that, mm-hmm. do have a high carbon footprint and still run on fossil fuels.
Right.
But in a place like the Cuyama Valley that has sort of transitioning out of oil, towns there do not have many opportunities beyond extractive industries and monoculture carrot farming that, you know, comes from Bakersfield. We touch on this a little bit in the film. The Cuyama used to be essentially a swampland, as I understand it. And it's a critically overdrafted water basin, mm-hmm. and now it is dry and brittle. And there, you know, this is a big thing to get into. But outdoor recreation is just one solution that can potentially supplant extractive industries, right?
Mm, right.
It includes horseback riding, it includes hiking, it includes riding, and somewhere like Cuyama, that's beautiful, you know, accessible to major populations, is really a great place to build trails sustainably and to let the local community drive it and to, you know, answer the call and to create jobs and livelihoods for those people.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is what I'm learning as well in understanding these environmental issues is that, you know, there's no such thing as no impact, right? I mean, just like the fact that we are human and we live, like we're going to need food and we're going to need, you know, a place to go to the bathroom and all that stuff. And so it is a matter of like, what can we kind of replace if it is this, you know, if it's monoculture agriculture or it's, you know, extractive industries like outdoor recreation? Yes, it's going to have an impact, but it's going to be much less than sort of these things that hopefully it's replacing. So that makes a lot of sense.
Totally. And it's a way into, in the same way, you know, in a microcosm, I was able to learn about these things through this one bike ride in the Los Padres. On an aggregate level, outdoor recreation is a way to, yeah, begin thinking like, how about creating community gardens or local food resilience or food sovereignty for, you know, indigenous communities? How do we support those efforts, you know, for those communities? Like that's reachable from the outdoor recreation world. And I think it, like I've said before, it colors in more beauty to like what it means to be a cyclist or whatever you are out on the land.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, earlier this year, you signed with Trinity Racing, which is a team that takes a pretty unique approach to racing across a number of cycling disciplines. Why did you decide to join the team?
Yeah, you know, it was a good opportunity for me to try different things, kind of have a little more freedom to hop in a road race, race some cyclocross, and think of the race calendar as a puzzle. And I can, you know, put the pieces down myself. And I think it was a good, it's a youthful team, but it's also got a lot of, you know, people who can throw their weight around against the pros. So it's been a lot of fun and it's cool to do something like the Tour of Britain in between the World Championships and Snowshoe World Cup.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I wanted to talk about your win at Snowshoe because it was a huge one for U.S. mountain biking. Were you thinking about sort of that, I guess, that accomplishment at the start of the race? Like, had you been tracking the number of years it had been since there was an American to win the cross-country World Cup race?
Yeah, I was well aware.
Really? Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I was, you know, I mean, it was on the forefront of my mind to break that drought. The biggest thing I wanted to do in my career, truly.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I mean, alongside my goal now, which is win a gold medal at Paris Olympics. But yeah, you know, for my entire life as a mountain biker from age 15, when I started going over to Europe, I've always known that the US is lagging behind and the women are crushing it, obviously. And the sheer fact that, yeah, they had three spots in the Olympics and we only had me shows our nation ranking. And I think that I'm the first of this wave of talent and development, including, you know, what's been brought forth from Nika, that will continue to put us on the top step.
Right.
And yeah, I've said this before, like my win in Snowshoe wasn't just a result for me. Like it was the result of all of this development from USA Cycling, you know, different youth riding programs that put me in that place. And
yeah,
there was a lot of work, like a lot of work.
Yeah, no doubt.
And it's going to continue. You know, we're not going to go 27 years without a World Cup win now.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, did you think it was going to happen at Snowshoe? Did you feel like that was where you were going to have a better chance than maybe some of the other races during the year?
I had zero expectation of winning Snowshoe.
Yeah.
Zero. You know, I like, especially after Tour of Britain, I was like, yeah, well, Snowshoe's the home race. Like, it'll be great to just be there, like finish the season. And then like halfway through Tour of Britain, I'm like, yeah, well, maybe actually this will put me on really good form for Snowshoe. And then I had a good short track. I was fourth in the short track on Friday in the World Championship jersey. I was like, all right, front row, new game plan. I'm not going for the top 20 like last World Cups.
Yeah.
I'm sticking in the front group and I'm staying there.
Yeah.
And then even like halfway through the race, I'm in the top five and I'm just waiting, patient. And I'm like, yeah, I feel good. And I had a moment, yeah, like wave at my mom and sister as I'm going by. And then a couple laps later, like look at my dad, you know, and who's who's been by my side at every race since I was 5 years old until pandemic. And this was the first race, Snowshoe, he was able to watch in 2 years. And
oh, wow. Yeah.
That moment when I looked at him and gave him this nod that like, I'm gonna fucking win this. Like, this is
yeah, that's awesome.
And that's when I like locked in and I knew what I was could do that day.
Yeah. That's really cool. Yeah. I was going to ask you if having your family there made a difference. I mean, it sounds like it. Were you able to have a lot more like friends and folks from here in the US as well at the race, like more than you normally would?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's incredible. And it was overwhelming, like doing the short track pre-ride in my World Champs jersey. And everyone is like, Christopher, you know, it's yeah. Oh, it's exciting, but it's like, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Here we are. We're in the US. I'm not just hearing LA, die, right. You know, as I do in Europe. So tons of friends, you know, so many conversations that were like 30 seconds that could have been 30 minutes there. I just didn't have time. And I really hope we can continue to bring the world to the US for mountain biking.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Such an inspiration to all these young riders who, like you said, are coming up through programs that they have available to them now, like NICA and all those kinds of groups. So that's super awesome to hear. I understand that you're studying entrepreneurship at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo. So who are some of the entrepreneurs that you admire?
Yeah. Well, I graduated in March, actually. I'm sticking out. Slow, but
congrats.
Thank you. It was it was underwhelming. It was like a slow trail off, you know, with Zoom classes and then and then I was focusing on the Olympics and I was like, oh yeah, by the way, I haven't really
a minor accomplishment compared to all the other things that happened in the last 12 months, but yeah.
Well, I mean it was it took me 5 years, 4.5, so not as bad as some other schools I could have gone to where I would have had a semester-based system. But anyways, I was entrepreneurship with a sociology slant. So really like social entrepreneurship.
Okay.
And I think that's really, you know, how I view creativity in business is like, how can it see a need for society, not just a market, but create a product or a service that can do good and be good, right? So yeah, there's quite a few people I learned about. The micro lending guy who started this company. Yeah. He's quite impressive. Like just something of that scale that you can create and use entrepreneurship.
Right.
Obviously drawing a blank on his name, but.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about. Eunice or it's something like that.
Yeah. There you go. I like the Cotopaxi model. You know, it's a B Corp and they're able to, I think that a lot of us get caught thinking of, you know, creating change on a global level, but understanding how we can have local impacts through our companies or whatever endeavor it is really powerful. So,
yeah,
you know, like I'm starting a company now called Stillspoke, and it's really a creative platform with a bunch of my best friends, film based, but we have this ecosystem around it. So if you will, we've got this hub that's, that's film. And then the spokes are, you know, merchandise, artist collaborations, magazine, stuff like that.
Cool.
And it's all about, you know, if we tell a story, something like the Long Traverse, how can we partner with local stakeholders to create an initiative, whether it's raising funds for them or hosting an event out there. So by the spring, we're hoping to have an event out in Koyama. And yeah, like I said, maybe raise money for something like a community garden or, or help create our outdoor recreation based economy out there. So yeah, that's the lens I look at what I learned in college from and how I apply it to cycling.
Yeah. That's really interesting because the traditional sort of entrepreneur model, you know, people will think of like Bill Gates or someone who he made a lot of money in business and then he started like giving back and doing the social side of it. Whereas, yeah, I mean, it sounds like your approach is from the beginning kind of incorporating the two and being successful. Doesn't just mean like being personally successful. It means like your community succeeds and these important things around it are succeeding as well, which is really cool.
Yeah. You know, I think it's, you know, it's different for everyone. I'm a bike racer, right? I'm not a computer coder at the height of the internet boom, but I think that wherever you are, there's like so much room to just be good in that and use whatever method it is, whether it's biking or coding, to not think on a scale-based level all the time, right? Like think about who are the people around me and how can I, you know, help benefit them or how can they benefit me? You know, it's a reciprocal relationship. And it's a sort of a paradox at times thinking of entrepreneurship and scaling things, right? And like creating, raising funds for whatever initiatives or whatever partners you want to get money from. But at the core of it, it's got to be like, what am I doing right now? How am I doing it? And what qualities to bring into that? Cause like that, especially in the sports space and in the outdoor space, like we need that approach desperately, you know, with, and against the backdrop of the climate crisis.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, you've done so many things in just the first 24, 25 years of your life. So what's next for you beyond sort of this still spoke? Because it seems like you kind of are always learning new things and trying new things. Is this something you're going to be doing like the rest of your life? Or, you know, do you think, do you see like other interests and things you want to explore later as well?
Yeah, well, you know, my primary goal, you know, until 2024 is to try to win a medal at the Paris Olympics. And it's the journey, not the outcome. You know, I really want to like stick to my craft, which is riding my bike and playing on my bike, but also training and pushing myself in something like an FKT. So that's number one goal. And then using that to kind of develop at this like real adult now, right? Like I'm out of college, like I'm in, you know, I'm setting up my life. And being able to use the bike to frame that is really an incredible opportunity and something I'm so grateful for.
Yeah.
Like not many kids my age have the chance to do what they love like this. And it's not something I take lightly. It's yeah, quite amazing, you know? And then being able to mix in something like Still Spoke, which will be a creative endeavor and is really supported by a lot of people who are the creatives, right? The filmmaker, art designer, photographers. And it's really a collective of sorts, you know? So being able to support human-focused media projects and then that tie into community initiatives, that's our goal. And, you know, the best thing I can do right now is is let the people who are able to tell those stories to tell them and keep continue learning in that process. So there's so much I'm interested in outside of cycling, but right now I'm a cyclist and I love it. And this is what I'm doing. And who knows in 3 years after Paris, where I'll be at.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Christopher, thanks so much for taking the time to chat and sharing your story and also the story of others in the cycling world. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, last thing I'll say is like, I've learned a lot this year, whether it was from college or this long traverse project. And I don't want to be, you know, I never want to be a professor sort of at a whiteboard telling people what to do. It's a group project, something we can learn together. And it's fun. Like it really is. And having fun on your bike is central to it. So I'm going to keep doing that. And I know people listening to this will as well.
Yeah. Well said. Well, thanks. Well, you can view the long traverse on November 26th. And you can find out more about Christopher's projects at stillspoke.com. We'll have that link in the notes. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.